scripture. The first is from the Old Testament, Genesis 45, 1 through 15. And that's on page 40 in your pew Bibles. Then Joseph could no longer control himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, "Send everyone away from me." So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, so dismayed were they at his presence. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come closer to me." And they came closer. He said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are 5 more years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his house, and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, 'Thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not delay. You shall settle in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me, you and your children, and your children's children, as well as your flocks, your herds, and all that you have. I will provide for you there, since there are 5 more years of famine to come, so that you and your household and all that you have will not come to poverty. And now your eyes and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see that it is my own mouth that speaks to you. You must tell my father how greatly I am honored in Egypt and all that you have seen. Hurry and bring my father down here." Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, while Benjamin wept upon his neck. And he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. And after that, his brothers talked with him.
Our second scripture reading this morning comes from the Gospel according to Matthew. We've been working our way through that. The bulletin says verses 10 through 28. I'm going to back up to number 1 just to give a little bit more context to the reading. Some Pharisees and teachers of the law from Jerusalem then came to Jesus and said, "Why do your disciples violate the tradition of the elders? They don't perform a ritual hand washing before they eat." And Jesus replied, "And why do you violate the commandments of God for the sake of your tradition? For God said, 'Honor your mother and your father,' and those who curse their mother and father must be put to death. But you say, 'Whoever says to their parents, any support you might have had from me is dedicated to God,' is no longer obligated to support them. You therefore nullify the word of God for the sake of your tradition. You hypocrites, Isaiah prophesied well when he said to you, 'These people honor me with their lips, while their hearts are far from me. Their worship for me is worthless, and their doctrines are mere human rules.'" Jesus called the crowd together and said to them, "Hear this and understand. It's not what enters your mouth that defiles you. It is what comes out of your mouth that defiles you. Then the disciples approached him and said, "Do you realize that the Pharisees are offended by what you just said?" Jesus replied, "Every plant that my Abba God in heaven has not planted will be pulled up by its roots. Ignore them. They are blind people leading other blind people. And when the blind lead the blind, they will all fall into a ditch." Then Peter said to him, "Explain this parable to us." And Jesus replied, "Do you still not understand? Don't you realize that everything that goes into the mouth passes into the stomach and eventually finds its way into the sewer and is gone? But what comes out of your mouth comes from your heart. This is what makes the person unclean. For from the heart come all sorts of evil intentions: murder, sexual infidelity, promiscuity, stealing, lying, even foul language. These things make a person unclean, not eating with unwashed hands." Jesus left there and departed for the district of Tyre and Sidon. It happened that a Canaanite woman living in that area came and cried out to Jesus, "Heir of the house of David, have pity on me. My daughter is horribly demon-possessed." Jesus gave her no word of response. The disciples came up and repeatedly said to him, "Please get rid of her. She keeps calling after us." Finally, Jesus turned to the woman and said, "My mission is only for the lost sheep of the house of Israel." So then she prostrated herself before him with the plea, "Help me, Rabbi." He answered, "But isn't it right to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs?" "True, Rabbi," she replied, "but even the dogs get to eat the scraps that fall from the table." Jesus then said in reply, "Woman, you have great faith. Your wish will come to pass." And at that very moment, her daughter was healed. May we be blessed by the reading, hearing, and pondering of God's holy word. I find that this is another one of those gospel stories, those gospel texts, that does not put Jesus in a particularly good or comfortable light. It's right up there with, "I bring a sword," and he comes to tip tables. And we end up wrestling with this. We want to sanitize it. We want to smooth out the rough edges and find something warm, something reassuring and comfortable hidden underneath and within the words. We want to say that the Canaanite woman is simply being tested and that Jesus knows all along what he is going to do. Or we say that Jesus was just using irony, or that Jesus was secretly inviting her to demonstrate her great faith. Or we say that Jesus was always intending to expand his mission beyond Israel. These interpretations make us feel better. They give us the warm and fuzzy and caring Jesus that we seek all the time. But there's a problem with that. None of these explanations are actually in the story. D. Mark Davis wrote, and I found this in some research I was doing for the day, "I would argue that as Jesus is made known to us on the whole, he would gladly test the faith of the pompous, self-righteous person of power and entitlement." It's what we heard in the first part of that pericope. But it seems strange that Jesus would do something so desperate that a desperate mother whose child is tormented. The words irony or test or feying or anything to that effect are not in the text unless we add them. The plain reading is that Jesus acts according to a limited view of his mission, and the mother responds according to the desperate need outside that which is the limited view. And with all of that, Jesus calls it faith. Perhaps Jesus really did believe that his mission was to the lost sheep of Israel. He's only going to go preach to the Jewish people that no longer go to synagogue. Perhaps he really did ignore a desperate mother's cries. Perhaps he really did say something deeply offensive to her. And perhaps the woman changes Jesus. That possibility makes this story far more interesting and far more challenging, because then this isn't simply a story about a woman proving her faith. It's a story about Jesus listening. It's a story about Jesus being challenged. It's a story about Jesus encountering someone who was outside of the boundaries that he had been taught to respect, and discovering that God's love is bigger than those boundaries. Here we are, 15 chapters into the Gospel according to Matthew, and this is the first time that Jesus has done anything for anyone outside of Israel. And if that is what is happening in this story, then maybe one of the most hopeful stories of the Gospel for us today. Because we live in a time when people are very good at drawing boundaries. We know who belongs and who doesn't. We know who is one of us and one who is one of them. We know which neighborhood we want to live in, which country is dangerous, what religions are trustworthy. We know which political party has all the answers and which one is ruining the country, which people are taking our jobs, our resources, our opportunities. We know who deserves compassion and who, somehow, has become an inconvenience. We may not use the same words as the people used 2,000 plus years ago, but the impulse is remarkably familiar. So let's look at where the story takes place first. Jesus has gone to the region of Tyre and Sidon, and that place matters because this isn't Jesus walking through the familiar Galilean village that we have heard all the way through chapter 14. He's in a foreign territory. He has crossed a boundary. He is among people from whom good Jewish people would have regarded as outsiders, as other. This is where he is now known as other. Jesus encounters a woman, and she is a Canaanite. And that word carries a lot of history. The Canaanites are not simply another ethnic group in the biblical imagination. They represent generations of conflict, suspicion, violence, religious difference, and cultural hostilities. And now one of these people comes to Jesus. And she's not asking for something for herself. Her daughter is suffering. She comes as a mother. She comes as a mom. And she cries out, depending on the translation that you have been reading, "Have pity on me. Have mercy on me. Kyrie eleison. Lord, heir to the house of David, my daughter is tormented by a demon. Heal her." And what is Jesus' first reaction? Absolutely nothing. He remains silent. Now, in his silence, the disciples get really annoyed. "Send her away," they say. They say, "Send her away," and they're looking for Jesus to do this. They're triangulating like crazy. They're not saying, "Let's see how we can help." They're not saying, "This woman is suffering." They don't even ask, "What does she need?" "Send her away. She's a problem. She's making noise. She's bothering them. She is definitely not their responsibility." And Jesus initially agrees with them. "I was sent only for the lost sheep, the house of Israel." There's the boundary. Israel. Not Canaan, not the Gentiles, not her. I'm going to be clear that the boundaries of Israel are very different 2,000 years ago than what they are today. But he's not there for her. And then comes the line that really makes us squirm. She came and lay down before him, saying, "Help me, Rabbi." And he answers, "It is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs." To the dogs. The word is an insult. We try to make it more comfortable by sometimes translating it as to a little dog, a puppy, something cute and fuzzy, a house pet. Israelites did not have dogs as house pets. They were a nuisance. And she answers, "Even the dogs eat the crumbs from their master's table." I quite often say, what happens if we change the tone of the words? So I wonder what her tone was. Was it anger seething underneath her teeth, under her breath? Even the dogs get to eat the scraps from the table. Was it in an exhausted whisper? Even the dogs get to eat the scraps from the table. But no matter what the tone is, something changes. Jesus says, "Woman, you have great faith. Let it be done as you wish." And her daughter is healed. There is certainly something powerful about this woman's persistence. She does not accept the first answer. She does not take silence as an answer. She doesn't allow the disciples to send her away. She does not accept the boundaries that have been drawn around God's mercy. She keeps asking. She keeps insisting. She keeps making herself visible. And she does so for the someone that she loves. She does this for her daughter. But I think we need to be careful about making this simply a story about persistence. Because if all we say is, be like the Canaanite woman, keep asking until Jesus gives you what you want, we have missed something even deeper. The woman is not merely persistent, she is perceptive. She recognizes something about Jesus that Jesus himself seems not yet to recognize. She understands that there is enough. There's enough mercy, healing. There's enough love and grace. She doesn't ask Jesus to abandon Israel. She doesn't ask him to take the bread away from the people that he's been with. She simply points out that God's abundance is greater than the boundaries being placed around it. There can be enough bread for the children and crumbs for the dogs. There can be enough mercy for Israel and for her daughter. There is enough. And perhaps that's one of the most important words that we need to hear today, is enough. Enough. Because so much of our public conversation is built around scarcity. There is not enough. There's not enough money, there's not enough housing, there's not enough health care, jobs, security, opportunity, resources. Fill in your blank. There's not enough. And when we believe, though, that there is not enough, we begin to decide who gets what is available. We begin sorting people into categories of deserving and undeserving. We begin building walls. And it's really hard to build a longer table when we are busy building higher walls. Now, sometimes these walls are physical walls being built. Sometimes they're legal. Sometimes they are economic. And sometimes they exist only within us. I think that there's another reason why Matthew gives us this story in place where he does this morning, and it's why I backed up just a little bit in that pericope. Just before this encounter, Jesus has been arguing with the Pharisees about purity. The Pharisees are concerned about religious traditions. They're concerned about what is clean and what is unclean. They are concerned, literally, about washing hands. And I won't ever say that washing your hands is a bad thing. Washing hands is always a good thing. But in their context here, it is like an absolute positive must. And Jesus says something startling. It isn't what goes into your mouth that defiles the person, it's what comes out of it. Because what comes out of your mouth comes from your heart. And Jesus lists some of the things that can emerge as not so clean from the human heart. Evil intentions, murder, theft, false witness, slander. In other words, the real danger isn't yesterday's lunch. The real danger is what we do to one another. The real danger is what comes out of us. Our words, our assumptions and contempt, our willingness to dehumanize another person, our willingness to turn a human being into a category. And that is where the story becomes particularly uncomfortable, because we have become extraordinarily skilled at doing this. We have social media algorithms that can feed us an endless stream of people who already we agree with, they agree with us. We can find the news station or source that feeds only what we want to hear. We can spend the entire day surrounded by voices telling us that our side is good and the other side is dangerous. And with all of that, we can turn complicated human beings into labels. And there's the long list of them, right? There's liberal, conservative, immigrant, MAGA, elite, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, illegal, woke, fundamentalist. We can go urban or rural, educated or uneducated. Where did your education come from? We end up turning complicated human beings into labels. And once we have reduced a person to a label, we don't have to listen to them anymore. We don't have to know their story. We don't have to wonder what they fear. We don't have to ask what they love. We don't have to see their face, and we definitely don't have to pay attention to their child. And that is precisely what makes this story so powerful. The disciples see a Canaanite. Not only is it a Canaanite, it is a Canaanite woman. Let's go down a little further on that list. Jesus initially sees someone outside the boundaries of his mission. Eventually, Jesus sees a human being, a woman, a mom, someone whose child is suffering. And once you see the person, the categories begin to fall apart. We know this feeling. Matthew's story is ancient, but the human experience is not. We know what it's like to be bothered by those people. We know what it's like to hear the complaint and think, not again. We know what it's like to hear someone else's suffering and immediately calculate why it is not our responsibility. We know what it's like to protect our own people first. Our own family, church, community, nation. Now, there's nothing wrong with protecting our own. Absolutely nothing wrong with that. The problem comes when our own becomes so large in our hearts, there is no room for anyone else. The problem comes when another person's humanity becomes invisible. And perhaps most troubling of all, we know what it's like to justify ourselves. We say we aren't prejudiced. We're just being realistic. We aren't afraid, we're just being cautious. We aren't excluding anyone, we're simply protecting what we have. We aren't being unkind, we're simply telling the truth. The human heart is remarkably creative when it comes to explaining why our behavior can be justified. And I think that's where the story really truly becomes extraordinary. The story shifts and Jesus changes. He changes not because the woman wins an argument, not because she manipulates him, and not because, but because he stops and he listens to her. He encounters someone whose experience is different from his own. He allows her reality to challenge his assumptions, and he changes. And that's a remarkable thing to say about Jesus, but it's exactly what the story tells us. And perhaps that's why we need that story today. Because in 2026, we desperately need to recover the possibility that changing our mind is not a weakness. Listening to someone who is not exactly like me, like you, is not a weakness. Admitting that we are wrong is not a weakness. Learning from someone we once dismissed is not weakness. Changing our hearts when we encounter another person's humanity is not weakness. It is strength. It is humility. It is wisdom. And if we are people who claim to follow Jesus, then we ought to be able to say, if Jesus could listen and change, perhaps we can too. If Jesus could encounter someone outside of his boundaries and discover that God's mercy was larger than he had imagined, perhaps we can too. If Jesus could hear a woman's voice when the disciples wanted her to be sent away, perhaps we can learn to listen when the voices around us say, send them away. So who are we sending away? That may be the question that the story offers us today. Who makes us uncomfortable? Whose suffering has become background noise? Whose voice do we dismiss before we hear what they are saying? Who have we decided is not really our responsibility? Who have we reduced to a category? Who have we called them? And I'm really glad the choir no longer sits here because I'd be pointing to them, and I don't want to point to them. What would happen if, instead of sending them away, we listened? What might change if we heard the story behind the label? What might change if we saw the mother instead of the Canaanite, the child of the immigrant, the neighbor instead of the political opponent, the person instead of the category, the human being instead of that one? This is not about pretending that our differences don't matter. They do. That's what makes us unique, is our differences. Our histories matter. Our cultures matter. Our religious traditions, our political convictions, our experiences all matter. But none of those things are larger than our common humanity. And none of them are larger than the possibility of compassion. I think I've mentioned this to a few of you in the room before. If you want a really good example of two people that can be so diametrically opposite of each other and sitting down and having a conversation, check out YouTube's The Enemies Project. And they put two people together. So there's three people in the room, the peacemaker and two people that you would think are diametrically opposed. And they end up having a conversation and finding out where their commonalities lie and how they can live with each other, still respecting where their histories are and their convictions are and their politics and their love are, but they can still talk to each other. It's called The Enemies Project. Now, I think that the woman has the best lines in the story, going back to the story this morning, but perhaps I think that she has the best lines because I'm a mom, right? That lends me a different perspective of seeing this story, because there isn't anything that I wouldn't do to keep my children safe, to keep my children healthy. And that goes for my nieces and nephews and now their children. I'm that mom. I'm going to be the one pleading, don't ignore my child. Just because I'm outside of the parameters that you have set, there has to be more. And Jesus does have the last word in the story, though. Woman, great is your faith. Notice he doesn't say, Canaanite, your faith is good, or Gentile, or outsider. He calls her woman. He sees her. And perhaps that's the miracle beneath the miracle. Her daughter is healed, but something else has been healed as well. A boundary has been crossed. A prejudice has been challenged. A mission has been expanded. A human being who was initially treated as an outsider is recognized as a person of great faith. And Jesus himself has been changed and challenged by the encounter. Another invitation, perhaps, for us. Not simply to be more like that Canaanite woman, although there are certainly times when we need her courage, her boldness, and her persistence, but also to be more like Jesus at the end of the story, willing to listen, willing to be interrupted, willing to encounter someone whose experiences challenges our assumptions, willing to discover that you don't have to have the whole story, willing to change, because faith isn't about having every answer. Faith may be the courage to remain open when someone else's experiences unsettles what we thought we knew. Faith may be the willingness to say, I hadn't thought about it that way. Maybe I made a mistake. Tell me more. Help me understand why you feel that way. I didn't know that. Maybe God's love is larger than what I ever imagined. It's another example of the theology of abundance. The Canaanite mom believed that there was enough mercy, healing, grace, enough room at the table, enough for Israel and for her and for all of us. And perhaps that's the good news that we need to hear. We do not have to protect God's love. We do not have to ration God's mercy. Here's the trick, they weren't ours to do that with anyways. They're from God, so we have no control over that. We think we do, we don't. We do not have to decide who is worthy of compassion. We don't have to decide who's worthy of compassion because we are all worthy of compassion. We do not have to build a smaller circle in order to make ourselves feel secure. God's abundance is larger than our fears. God's mercy is larger than our categories. God's love is larger than our boundaries. And when we encounter the person we have been taught to fear, perhaps we can remember this mom. Perhaps we can listen. Perhaps we can allow ourselves to be changed. Perhaps we can discover that the person we thought was other was simply another human being standing before us, making the same things, asking for the same things that we ask for. The same things we ask for: help, mercy, dignity, safety, a future for our children, a place at the table. And perhaps, like Jesus, we will discover that the table was never as small as we thought it was to begin with, because there is enough. There has always been enough. And if Jesus can change, perhaps we can too. Perhaps that is what great faith looks like for us today. Not certainty, not having all the answers, not defending everything that we've always believed, but remaining open enough to hear the voice of the person standing outside of our boundaries and courageous enough to let that encounter change our hearts today and every day. Amen.